It appears that Florida's elections are not yet over. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a recount already in the Senate race, and it could be another one in five other races. But what does a recount entail, and what's the likelihood the outcome will be any different?
There is still not enough votes out there to make a difference in those races.
We hear from the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. Also, it was 1964 when a brash young boxer named Cassius Clay shook the world, as he put it, and became the heavyweight champion in a fight here in South Florida. Well, now playing at the Colony Theater, Miami Beach, a show called One Night in Miami. The story of that night when Clay won.
Our play is not about the public face of these men. What we want to do is capture the friendship of these individuals.
Finally, if you're a fan of the PBS series Downton Abbey, well, there's an exhibit now open in West Palm Beach to satisfy the craving. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Republicans had some big victories in Florida on Tuesday. As it stands, the GOP held onto the governor's mansion and they won a U.S. Senate seat. Yes, there are reports of recounts, and we'll have more on that later in the program. Now, we should note, if you or someone you know has filed a provisional ballot, you have until 5 p.m. today to contact the supervisor of elections office or show up in person to verify that you're registered to vote. We have full details on our website, WLRN.org. Earlier today, we spoke with Blaise Ngolia. He's the state representative in the 35th District and the chair of the Republican Party of Florida. We talked about those recounts and just how close the races really were. Mr. Ngolia, Republicans kept control of the governor's mansion. They took the Senate seat. There is still a discussion about a recount, but we'll talk about that in a minute. The party did lose a few House seats. They eventually lost the House in Congress. You used the language on Tuesday night. The supposed blue wave just hit a big red wall. Overall, tell us about what Tuesday night was like for you.
Exciting, exhilarating. I believe this is the first time since Reconstruction that Florida Republicans have won every contest at the top of the ticket, U.S. Senate, and every member of the U.S. Every member of the Florida cabinet. It's an exciting time right now. We worked extremely hard, as evidenced by the massive turnout on Election Day, and we're just happy. We like where we're at.
Now, again, I mentioned the recount. We're still following this story because we don't know yet. There's still votes being counted. And it is really close in the governor's race, the Senate race, and four other state races. If it reaches the 0.5%, then there would be an automatic recount. Really, what have you heard from state officials or anybody else on what's going on right now?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, yes, it is. It is a little bit closer now than it was on election night, but there is still not enough votes out there to make a difference in those races. Ron DeSantis still will be the governor. Rick Scott will still be the next U.S. senator for the state of Florida. There is just not enough votes out there that are uncounted to change the election outcomes.
Now, this story brings me back to the recount of the presidential election in Florida back in 2000. What recounts have you experienced or seen in your lifetime, and how do you describe that process to somebody?
Well, I've been chair of the Republican Party of Florida for 4 years now. This is obviously the first statewide recount, the biggest one, and it wasn't even a full statewide recount. It was a partial because the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in 2000. I've been part of some smaller ones locally, and the process, I'll explain the process for you, is everybody has to, all the local supervisors of elections have to get their information up to the Secretary of State by this Saturday, and this Saturday, the Secretary of State will make a determination of what meets the statutory threshold of a recount, and that is less than 0.5%, and then they will proceed with a machine recount, and then after that, if anything meets the statutory requirement of 0.25%, then that will be a manual recount.
And you just said a second ago that it's there are not enough votes, you know, to change anything. But where are you getting that information? How do you know that?
So that's sort of like common sense and just basic math. So if you take Rick Scott's lead right now, he's leading at about 22,000 votes. And that would be 22,000 extra Democrat votes. So in order for that to happen, and the two counties that have not reported yet so far who finished counting are Palm Beach and Broward County, which, you know, if I have to remind you, every time we have problems in Florida elections, it always seems to be Broward and Palm Beach. But in order for there to be a 22,000 net change, and that's the key, net change in the election results, adding 22,000 for Bill Nelson, you're talking about having to count another 80,000 ballots or so. And if there is 80,000 ballots laying around at this point, then there is only two possible ways that that could happen. Massive, massive voter fraud or massive, massive incompetence. So the 22,000 threshold is pretty safe. So that's why we're pretty confident that Rick Scott is going to be the U.S. Senator.
So if everything stays the same, what do you see as the most pressing issue for the governor-elect DeSantis in his first 90-100 days?
Well, obviously, it's going to be transition. He's getting his transition team ready right now, filling a lot of the talking to a lot of people, filling a lot of slots, making sure that he has his key people in key places so he can hit the ground running on day one.
We're talking with Blazing Goley, a state representative in District 35, also the chair of the Republican Party of Florida, talking about election results from Tuesday night. I do have to ask you about there was the shooting last night at a club in Southern California, 12 people dead, including the shooter. In the next session, issues of guns and mental health likely will come back up. Where do you see this conversation going next?
I think, look, we're always going to have conversations about safety, especially when it comes to our schools. I don't think we're done having the conversation about mental health issues. So I think you'll see a lot of that continue to surface here in the Florida legislature during the next session.
And when you talk about mental health, I mean, one of the things I haven't heard yet is, I mean, what does that look like? If you could give me an idea, is it more mental health experts in schools, government offices, you know, and how's that paid for? If people's insurance isn't covering some of that treatment or they don't have insurance, I mean, how do we get more mental health experts and help to people?
So I think the one thing that I would say is that, I think we need some more mental health experts in identifying mental health earlier. And whether that happens in the schools or whether it happens in our communities, making sure that we're identifying that, I think that's going to be key. And how we do that is going to be a conversation that we're going to have amongst the legislature and the chamber and the governor's office. But obviously, it's going to be paid for with taxpayer funds. But I do want to dispel a misnomer out there where everyone thinks that Florida is one of those states that has one of the lowest dollar amounts that goes towards mental health funding. We're set up differently. So we set up where a lot of our Medicaid, it's done by third-party providers, and mental health services are included in that. So when you look at our budget, what happens often is they read our mental health funding line and they think that's all we spend on mental health, whereas a lot of the money that we spend on Medicaid, the billions of dollars, a lot of that is included, but it's not broken out. So we do spend more on mental health, but there's still a lot more that we need to do and we will continue to do because it's an important issue for Floridians.
I want to ask you about strategy real quickly. Do you think the strategy that you used in this election to achieve victory is the same one you're going to need in 2020? You know, Democrats are going to have to regroup and they're going to come at you harder.
Actually, I think next election is going to be pretty hard for the Democrats, because if you're a Democrat, you were sitting there and you were very, very excited. You turned out in record numbers and you still lost. So I think the Democrat Party is going to have some regrouping to do. I think that they're going to be deflated, and I think that deflation is going to carry over into 2020. We're excited, Republicans. We've turned out a massive amount of voters, historic amount of voters, and a lot of that has to do with great policies that we continue to advocate for. We have that. A lot of that has to do with our president, which drives a lot of people out to the polls. So going into 2020, I wouldn't want to be in any other position than where we're at right now.
Let me finish with this. Almost all of the amendments passed, all but one. One of them was a controversial Amendment 4, which now gives voting rights back to more than a million people who had felony convictions. A lot of questions as to how the amendment will be implemented, considering the new Attorney General and Governor-elect Ron DeSantis have expressed concerns over it. How do you see the new law being implemented?
That I can't answer. That is a when you get to Tallahassee in session, there will be numerous what we call implementing bills that are going to be offered by various members of the House and the Senate. And that's a conversation we're going to have in the Senate is how we implement that bill. I can't answer that. That is a legislative leadership question that we all have to have with our members. And we're going to get it done this session. What it's going to look like, obviously, we don't know, but we are going to implement the will of the people.
And Mr. Angolia, you know, coming back, I mean, Florida, even with the victories you saw, these are tight races. It's a very divided state. The president alluded to this yesterday, to the divisiveness throughout his news conference. I'm curious to what extent the Republican Party is reaching out and trying to court Democratic voters or maintaining that, you know, steadfast with the base. What's the strategy again?
Well, I think the first thing that that Democrats have to understand is that we want to work with the other side. We want input, but they also have to understand that, you know, we continually get elected in Florida because people are happy with the way that we are governing, evidenced by the fact that, look, New York is the same size as the state of Florida in terms of population, but we have half the budget. There's a reason why people move to Florida, and that is because we are low tax, low regulatory. We have sunshine. We have coastline. It is a great place to live, raise a family, start a business. And if we start taking that away, then we start going in the opposite direction of where we're headed. And I think a lot of Floridians like the direction that we're headed, and that's why we do well in these elections.
Blaise Angolia, again, state representative in District 35, which, by the way, he won his reelection bid this week. He's also the chair of the Republican Party of Florida. Mr. Angolia, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And now I want to turn over to Jim Defeedy, investigative reporter for CBS 4 News Miami and host of Facing South Florida, for more analysis on Tuesday night's election results and, of course, these recounts, these potential recounts. Jim, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Good afternoon.
All right, let's talk about the recounts and also what you heard. I mean, there could be a recount in the Senate race, in five different races. There are four state posts that could be looked at very closely. The Ag Commissioner is one of them. You just heard the GOP chairman, Blaise Angolia. He said, doesn't matter. There aren't enough uncounted votes out there to make a difference. So from what you heard and everything that's going on, what's your take?
There's a lot of truth in what Blaise said, but the difference is that when you get into a hand recount, that's where, you know, it becomes a new ball game, because you start going through ballots, ballot by ballot, and start looking at them in different sort of ways. So, for instance, you know, what you're looking for are undervotes and overvotes. So let's say that somebody filled in both bubbles, you know, for the Senate position. They filled in Scott, and then they said, oh, no, I filled in the wrong one. I meant to fill in Nelson. And then they draw a line through the Scott's name. The one of the things that will happen in a hand recount is they'll look at that, and then they will try to say, can we determine the voter's intent? And if the voter's intent by the canvassing board is, well, clearly they crossed out Rick Scott's name, they circled Nelson, they filled in both bubbles by mistake, this is a vote for Bill Nelson. So the question becomes, are there enough stray votes like that? Provisional ballots that are being counted now. My guess is that by Saturday at noon, when the 67 county supervisors send their final numbers to Tallahassee, that 22,000 number will likely come down, shrink even more. So I expect that there will be machine recounts, probably even in the governor's race, in the Senate race, and in the Ag Commissioner's race. I think that the Senate race and the Ag Commissioner's race will go to a hand recount then, which means we'll be dragging this out for the next at least a month, I would imagine, if not two.
Has there ever been a recount that changed the results that you can remember?
Well, there have been recounts that have, yeah, I do believe there are. I can't cite them off the top of my head. And this is different than Bush v. Gore in 2000. And by the way, let me just make one point really clear, because sometimes we look at Florida and say, this is an awful system that we have here. This is why we have paper ballots, is for this exact circumstance. In 2000, we had the hanging Chad, the dimple Chad, the pregnant Chad, all those sorts of things that you remember from that bad system back in the day with punch cards. We then moved to a system of touch screens, if you remember. For a brief period of time, some counties were doing where you would touch the screen on the person you want to vote for. But people were nervous with that because there was no trail then after that. So then we moved to paper ballots. And paper ballots are in place for this very purpose, so that if there is a question as to the results, you can physically, if you need to, count every ballot by hand. It's actually a good system that's in place right now. Now, the one thing I will say, I think that even Bill Nelson is difficult. It would be difficult for him to make up the votes. I think in the ag commissioner's race, it very well could change. And I think Nikki Fried may actually turn out to be the winner in that race at the end of the day.
And do you think that anything happens in the gubernatorial race?
I think that it goes to a machine recount. And a machine recount, very little changes. Just so you understand what happens in a machine recount, they take all 8 million ballots and run them back through the machine. So usually the numbers just vary very little. You know, you don't get big changes. It's only, so in a machine recount, which is under 0.5%, you do that. You run them all through the machine again. If after the machine recount, it gets down to the quarter point, as Blaise was saying before, then you go to the manual recount, and that's where it gets more contentious. Let me just give you one more example so you understand of why this becomes a contentious process. So let's say it goes to a manual recount in all 67 counties. If there's a poll worker working in Miami-Dade County handling a ballot, right, that poll worker will sit there. Behind him will be a representative of the Democratic Party and a representative of the Republican Party. So there will be two people hovering over every single worker and lawyers behind them looking at every ballot to make sure that the ballots are counted properly. That becomes a slow, tedious process.
There's a visual that you just gave me, and it's really hard to accept it, but to even believe that. But all right, so everything, if it stays as it is, let's just talk about what happened on Tuesday night. Again, Republicans win the governor's seat. They take the Senate seat. They lose a couple of House seats. Overall, I mean, really, was there any surprise to Tuesday, considering that we were told that the races were virtual ties?
Well, in a sense, there were some crazy polls out there that had the Democrats ahead by 7 or 8 points going into Election Day. I never believed that. Here's what's not a surprise. 2016 was not a fluke. So everyone looked at 2016 and thought, oh, Donald Trump won Florida. What a bizarre turn of events that was. That's got to be an aberration. And 2 years later, it was deja vu all over again. The exact same thing that happened in 2016 happened in 2018. The Democratic counties, Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, up in Duval, other counties, performed well for Democrats. But the rest of the state, those smaller Republican counties, performed even better. So while Miami-Dade and Broward are going to come in at around 56-57% in terms of turnout, the rest of the state, the Republican parts of the state, were turning out at 62%. You know, I apologize, I got my numbers wrong. Dade and Broward came in at around 57%, and the rest of the state came in at 62%. If Dade and Broward had matched the state levels, if Dade and Broward had voted at 62%, Andrew Gillum would be the governor, Bill Nelson would be returning to the Senate, and likely you would have a Democratic majority among members of the cabinet. Nikki Fried would be the next ag commissioner, and on it would have went. So the fact that Dade and Broward did not meet the numbers of the rest of the state is why the Democrats are coming up short right now.
All right. So, I mean, overall, the turnout was better than 2014. But as you're saying, at least in these counties, turnout not as good as in other parts of the state. Why? Why is that? Why do you think that turnout is still such a challenge, especially in the midterm?
It's always going to be a challenge in the bigger counties to turn out people in bigger numbers. Let me give a different perspective on one aspect of it. We spent a lot of time talking about younger voters, you know, turning out. And younger voters did turn out in higher numbers this time. But here's the secret of Florida. And maybe it's just because we accept it as going back so long that we don't remember this sometimes. But it's the older voters in the state of Florida that count. The points that Blaze made before about people who move here, come here because the taxes are low and the weather is good. You've got a lot of older people moving into the state of Florida who aren't looking for hope and change. They aren't looking for somebody to come in and shake the state up like Andrew Gillum was promising. They're not looking for any of that. They've settled here from New York, from Cleveland, from Ohio, from the Midwest. They've retired. They're here. They want their taxes low. They don't want a lot of change, and they just want to move along as quietly as possible. They don't want anything to change. So when the Democrats come through with agents of change, they do not do really well. The Villages, that massive complex around near Orlando, turned out their voter turnout in that county, 78%. Older voters vote, and they tend to vote for the status quo.
We're talking with Jim DeFede, investigative reporter for CBS4 News Miami and host of Facing South Florida, talking about the election results from Tuesday. Let's go through a couple of quick races here, Jim. Debbie Mercosal Powell defeats Carlos Curbelo in District 26. What happened in that race?
So healthcare happened in that race. Carlos Curbelo tried to moderate his views in many sort of ways, tried to present himself as someone who could challenge Donald Trump on a case-by-case basis and needed to, and prove his independence. But the thing that really hung around Carlos Curbelo were repeated votes to repeal Obamacare. That district that he represented, 100,000 people had signed up for Obamacare. Eliminating Obamacare, even with its faults, would have been devastating to that community. Debbie Mercosal Powell came in running on the issue of health care and was able to take that seat with the help of a lot of money. The Democrats spent a ton of money in that race. That was the most expensive congressional race in the state of Florida. More than $20 million was pumped in by both Democrats and Republicans in that contest. She ends up winning it by about 3 points, I think it was at the end of the day, 2 or 3 points. You know, it was a good win for her. She becomes the first Ecuadorian to be a sitting member of Congress, the first member of Congress born in South America. And one of the things it tends to show is the changing dynamics of South Florida and Miami-Dade County. Whereas once it was all Cuban Americans dominated, we are now seeing the growing influence of Ecuadorians, Venezuelans, Colombians, and others coming into the county and now rising up in the political process as well.
The other race I wanted to ask you about real quickly, too, is District 27. Donna Shalala defeats Maria Elvira Salazar. She barely speaks any Spanish, and she did a lot of Spanish debates. How did she do this?
Through translators. you know, that was the end of the day. She went into that community and did the best she could. Donna Shalala had the benefit of running in a district that Hillary Clinton won in 2016 by 20 points. So there was always a Democratic advantage in that district once Ileana Ross Layton retired from it. The fact that she was able to win it, you know, shouldn't be a big shock to anyone. The question for but again, and it goes back to that issue that I was saying before about Cuban Americans. I'm not saying that they're devoid of power. They're still a very powerful bloc in Miami-Dade County. But clearly, you're seeing a change. Two Cuban American representatives are now gone. South Florida used to be represented by 3 Cuban Americans. Now Mario Diaz-Balart is the last person standing.
Let me finish with this as briefly as you can. With the results, unless anything changes with the recounts, but as the results as they are, how does that shape the 2020 election?
You know, Blaze made a really good point before, because I do think Democrats on the national level are going to have to rethink whether or not they have to come up with a roadmap to the White House that still includes Florida. Florida is a tough state for them. It's an expensive state. You know, between all the spending in Florida, there was some $300 million spent between the Senate race and the governor's race, you know, down here in Florida. The Democratic Party is going to have to start thinking, could we take $100 or $200 million? Do we want to spend it in Florida? Or do we come up with a map that goes through Wisconsin, Iowa, Nevada, Arizona, maybe Georgia? So that's going to be something that's going to be really interesting. The other thing, you saw progressive candidates across the country lose in a lot of races, including Andrew Gillum. Does that blunt the momentum of the more progressive elements of the Democratic Party as they move forward in 2020? Does it signal that maybe Joe Biden, who isn't necessarily as progressive as, say, a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker, does Joe Biden now say, the lane is more open for me?
I know it's 2 years away, but that is kind of how we do things. We're already moving on to the next election. Jim DeFede, again, investigative reporter for CBS 4 News Miami, host of Facing South Florida. Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, there's a show at the Colony Theater that tackles racism and social inequality. It's about the night Cassius Clay won the heavyweight title in Miami Beach. It's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, do you remember the famous civil rights ballad, A Change Is Gonna Come by Sam Cooke? It's that song that plays throughout this new show playing right now at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. It's called One Night in Miami, and it's loosely based on the story of the night of February 25th, 1964 in Miami, the night when a young boxer named Cassius Clay, who won the heavyweight title, celebrated in an Overtown motel room with his three best friends, Sam Cooke, Jim Brown, the legendary football player, and Malcolm X. Clay eventually changed his name to Muhammad Ali while he was in South Florida. Now, the entire play is set in this room in the Hampton House Motel. In the play, we see what happens that night in the hotel room. There are heated discussions between these friends. Malcolm X is deciding whether or not to break from the Nation of Islam. There's musical numbers from Sam Cooke, revelations from Jim Brown, who just might become a movie star. And then, of course, Cassius Clay changing his name. We spoke with Esau Pritchett, who plays the football star Jim Brown, and Michelle Hausman, who's the artistic director of Miami New Drama at the Colony Theater. The play, again, showing at the Colony Theater, Miami Beach, through November 18th.
You know, you played Jim Brown. I mean, all the characters in this play are globally iconic figures. Mm. You play this, you know, legendary football player. How do you prepare for this role? What did you do specifically?
I feel like I've been preparing for a long time, man. My father, huge football fan. My father was a college football player. And I remember even before I was interested in the sport, he would always talk about this guy, Jim Brown. Boy, Jim Brown was bad. You know, my father was from outside Montgomery, Alabama. And so finally when I started to watch the sport and being from Michigan, I was watching Barry Sanders, Detroit Lions. And I was convinced that he was the best, you know, back that ever carried a ball. So eventually I started to watch some archival footage of Jim Brown on the football field. And it was like a superhero. I mean, it was something I wish that anybody who follows the sport in today's game could watch the archival footage of Jim Brown and recognize that this dude is the best football player who ever lived. He was before his time. So in terms of preparation, just listening to Jim in a few interviews, the few times that I've seen him, one of the things that we didn't want to do is that we didn't want to create an impression or impersonation of the characters. We wanted to capture the essence. And, you know, I think about Jim at that time. I think about what masculinity was considered to be at that time. Some of the things about the way he would move and stand and, you know, of course, where his voice lives. We talked about that earlier. He's way down here. Just a few things like that. But ultimately, for our purposes, our play is not about the public face of these men. So we don't have to play the public persona. What we want to do is capture the friendship of these individuals. So we have all these giant icons that people recognize in public, but that's not the angle that we're coming from. So we actually want to reveal them a little bit more as human beings, and we're not trying to pedestalize them or sanitize them. We're just making them men. We're making them men, making them friends in a room.
This is fascinating, Michael, and I'm curious too, because as he said, it's not about trying to sound like the characters. Muhammad Ali, you had your actor. He wasn't trying to really pull off the Ali voice. Malcolm X, same thing. He had a very specific way he talked. But your actors were not trying to mimic. They were just portraying these characters, these roles. Was that on purpose?
Yes. So the director of this show is Carl Caulfield. Carl is He's been a friend of mine for a long time. He's a Miamian who now is the associate artistic of Classic Theater of Harlem. And I think that, you know, this is something that we've talked about a lot, was the idea that, you know, doing an impression is an easy thing. What is really hard is to kind of capture the essence and the soul of a person. So they might sort of sound and look like those characters, but it is obvious that they are not. But I think that the work done by Carl and the cast is impressive. I think that especially, you know, Leon Thomas, who plays Sam Cooke, seeing him sing, he doesn't sing exactly like Sam Cooke, but he sings in a way that also touches your soul like Sam Cooke touched your soul. It's unbelievable.
Why is this show so important? And I mean, I'm going to get to the fact that it's an all-male cast, all men of color. It's a very unique show in that sense. But why this show? Why is it so important right now?
Miami New Drama, we only do work that is in immediate conversation with our community, and it's as multicultural and multilingual as the city we live in. I think that this show, it's evident, you know, its importance. We live in the era of Colin Kaepernick. We live in the era where suddenly bigotry seems to be accepted, maybe a little bit disguised, but you saw from you know, from some of the electoral ads and comments that racism is still a tool to excite your base. And I think that the importance of this show is that we live in a city where we don't have a monument of the Jim Crow era or, you know, a statue to commemorate segregation. And, you know, most of the city is like me, who speak with an accent because 54% of us are foreign born. And it's easy to come here and forget that this was the Deep South.
We're talking about a show performing now at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. It's called One Night in Miami. It's a story of the night that Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, won the heavyweight title in Miami Beach and celebrated in an Overtown motel with football legend Jim Brown, singer Sam Cooke, and civil rights leader Malcolm X. We're joined now by Esau Pritchett, who plays Jim Brown, and Michelle Hausman, who is the artistic director of Miami New Drama at the Colony Theater. It's playing through November 18th. From both of you, Michelle, I want to hear from you as well, is also tell me about the audiences and their response to the show. What have you seen and heard from people who've come to see the show so far?
Well, the great thing about doing it here is that, you know, this is a place where it actually happened. You know, the show started in L.A. It went to Baltimore, Denver, London, South Africa. And the beautiful thing was to be able to bring it right back here to where the historical event actually happened. So a number of people that we're running into in talkbacks or even on the street were people who were around when this happened, who remember the time of segregation, people who met Cassius, people who knew some of these individuals at that time here in Miami. So that makes that particularly special, you know, because obviously we didn't get that when we were in other places. You know, I don't want to give anything away about the show, but this is what our playwright Kim Powers has done. It's absolutely brilliant. You are going to get a history lesson in this show, but not in a way that you would go to a history lecture, because if you went to a history lecture, you'd be getting lectured too. And you would be taking notes and it'd be like being in school and it might be boring. But he's been able to wrap it in what it is that we are required to do as performers and artists and entertainers. We must entertain at the same time that we draw attention to history or that we educate.
Yeah, Michelle, I mean, have people come up to you? I wonder the fact that this is where it happened.
You know, it's impressive the response we've gotten from audience. It brought something in the community that felt like we needed to talk about this. You know, the fact that we've hidden and we've been silenced about our history, you know, this show was evident that there is way more conversations that we should be having that we are not having.
Yeah. And I'd like to make one more comment about that too, man. I found it really interesting. I didn't know about the Hampton House. I didn't know that that area and that place was considered like, you know, the Harlem of the South. So we got a chance to go to the museum that actually was the Hampton Inn, the hotel converted into a museum, and saw all the pictures of all the, you know, quote-unquote black celebrities, elites who had been through. I didn't know that Dr. King put the finishing touches of I Have a Dream right at the Hampton Inn.
Not to give anything away, so this show, I mean, we follow these four men after the big fight, and they're hanging out in this room together. And characters come and go. They step in, they step, I mean, you know, the different actors on the stage come in and come go, and go. So you have this fascinating back and forth between individuals. At one point, Isai, your character is with Malcolm X, just the two of you alone.
Right.
This was really interesting because you started arguing with each other, and then your character says to him, "What do you understand? You're a light-skinned black man." Mm-hmm. Take us to that scene. What's going on?
The brilliant thing about this play, and I say it again and again and again, I you know, sometimes as actors, we try to, our hats on as dramaturgs and really dig into, you know, the deep layers of a play. And one thing I'll say about Kemp's play is that it is a fat onion. You can keep peeling and peeling and peeling and getting to it. And much like a brilliant short story writer, he's been able to pack so much in. And what is our show run, Michelle?
80 minutes.
In 80 minutes. This is absurd that he could pack so much in. So there's this thing in black culture that's called colorism, right? And it's created by living in a nation where the premium of your worth is your race or related to your skin color. So for a lot of our history, those people who were of a lighter tone were more preferred by the dominant culture and therefore allowed more privileges, as it were. So obviously that would create within, you know, our race as a whole, enmity and a bit of conflict. So it's interesting. We talk about that. I talked to Ken Powers the other day, the playwright. And whenever we have a house of many, many African-American people, many black folks, it lands like everybody gets it.
What do you hope the audience takes away? Michelle.
You know, we are successful when an audience member leaves with more questions than answers. I think that this is a show that forces you to encounter something you didn't know existed. And then it's not giving you a recipe. Is the beauty, the poetry of this play is that it takes place in 1964, but you can't forget throughout the entire 80 minutes that you are in 2018. So, you know, having those two times coexisting in your head is brilliant.
You know, as a black man in America who's pretty astute with our history, when I read this script, I was embarrassed that I did not know this. I was embarrassed. I couldn't believe it. I mean, look at the icons that we're talking about. Sam Cooke would be Michael Jackson of his time. Jim Brown, it's still considered one of the greatest athletes of all time. Malcolm X, just an absolute political mastermind, rhetorical genius. And of course, Cassius Clay, who would become Muhammad Ali. These dudes were really good friends, and I didn't know that. There's something wrong in that. Right? So now I feel really good that we have an opportunity to educate an audience that these things did happen.
The music for the show, the Sam Cooke music for the show, I mean, how did it play into it and how did you pick it?
This show is really about the birth of A Change Is Gonna Come, you know, that magnificent Sam Cooke song. And I think it's, you know, it's that growth from the early Sam Cooke songs to a Sam Cooke who wrote the anthem of the civil rights movement. And it goes to show you the importance of how art can never be divorced from politics. He wrote a song that became political. We are doing this play because we believe in its political impact. So, art and politics and social change are always very intertwined.
That was Michelle Hausman. You also heard Esau Pritchett. We were talking about the show being performed now at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. It's called One Night in Miami, the story of the night Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, won the heavyweight title in Miami Beach, then celebrated in an Overtown motel with football legend Jim Brown, singer Sam Cooke, and civil rights leader Malcolm X. Esau Pritchett plays Jim Brown, and Michelle Hausman is the artistic director of Miami New Drama at the Colony Theater. It's playing through November 18th. Check out the photos that we have on Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundown. If I could just say, a really fun show. Still to come, a special treat for fans of the Downton Abbey series. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, lovers of the hit PBS drama Downton Abbey will hear that music and perhaps reflect fondly on the six-year run of the program. The show is the most popular drama ever on PBS, reaching 26 million viewers and going to 250 territories around the globe. Well, Abbey addicts have an opportunity this weekend to see the home and attire of the Crawley family come to life in a special traveling experience. The Downton Abbey exhibition opens in City Place in West Palm Beach this Saturday and displays 50 of the show's original costumes, the dining room and bedrooms used by the Crawleys, background information on the show's production, and a whole bunch more. Gareth Neame was the executive producer for the show in its six-year run and is the executive chairman for Carnival Films, the company that produced Downton Abbey, and he joins us now via FaceTime from City Place. Gareth, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here in the Sunshine State.
All right. Well, first of all, enjoy the weather because this is when it's at some of its best. So where did the idea to convert Downton Abbey into an exhibition come from?
Well, it started with there was a much smaller scale tour of some of the costumes from the show, and that did quite well. There was a lot of interest in that, and so from that, it certainly wasn't my idea to do the exhibition, but my colleagues at NBC Universal said, well, you know, the costumes were so popular, why don't we consider developing a much, much bigger and more immersive experience that could take fans of the show, you know, into the parts of the building the story was set in and see all the costumes and the sets and video footage and background information to the making of the show and the historical context of the times that the show was set in. So, yeah, that's how it came about. And we obviously launched it. We launched it about a year ago in New York City, and it's had a very successful run there until September. And in recent weeks, I think 27 big trucks have come down the East Coast and have unpacked everything here, ready for Floridians to come in their masses, hopefully, to come and enjoy it.
And so if I get to City Place and I'm visiting the exhibition, take me through this. What's the first thing I'm going to experience?
Well, you'll have performances by members of the characters from the show. We'll speak to you. There's film of them speaking to you directly as the audience. They'll introduce you to the environment. You'll walk through a series of rooms that replicate completely the servants' quarters of Downton Abbey itself, and then indeed some of the family quarters. You'll walk through video installations that will show numerous clips from the show with much more context to them than you would see if you were just watching, you know, the DVD box set. You know, this gives you some background to the whole thing. And then you'd see some of the upstairs rooms that the family inhabit. You'll see 50 costumes of the most iconic costumes from the television show, including the dress that Lady Rose wore when she was presented to the King and Queen as a debutante, all of the wedding dresses worn by the likes of Edith and Mary, and numerous other costumes. That's one of the best elements of the whole experience. And of course, there's a fantastic store on site, which has got brilliant products for this gifting time of the year, or as we approach the gifting time of the year, which is, you know, the perfect store for a Downton fan to be absorbed in.
Yeah, the show has, as I mentioned, and you already know this, this international following, and it's the most popular drama ever produced from PBS. How is a show that takes place more than 100 years ago, following an aristocratic family, manage to gather such a universal appeal?
Well, it's a good question, and it's one, you know, I've been asked many times over all of these years. It's hard to put one's finger on it completely. I suspect it is to do with the fact that this is a quintessentially British genre. You know, the English country house, the period drama is, you know, these things only really get done in Britain. So it's got something unique about it. But unlike shows that have come before, this isn't an adaptation of an old novel where you're kind of limited by the story that you've inherited. This is an original piece of writing with originally created characters. And so the storytelling, you know, is very up to the minute. Although the show set 100 years ago, the storytelling is very contemporary. The dilemmas that the characters go through are very similar to the things that we have to deal with today. They've got the same objectives in life that we've got. But I think also at the heart of it, it's a show about a family, both literally the family, the Crawleys, but the wider family that are their servants who work for them. It's a community, and they all have to act together and pull together And that's something that I think in a family drama context, people find very appealing. And then I think the final piece would be that it really does combine. I mean, you'd call the TV show a drama, not a comedy, but it combines drama with a lot of comedy in a way that's, you know, relatively unusual, and also romance, you know, good old fashioned romance. There's, you know, which is not really very fashionable on television, but we don't really have, you know, much sex and violence. We have good old fashioned romance. Will they, won't they? And that is something that perhaps while we thought it was pretty unfashionable when we started on the show, it really seems to have connected with audiences around the world who've enjoyed that. So yeah, family, drama, comedy, and romance, and you know, the familiar setting of the old English country estate.
I know that there's the works for the Downton Abbey movie. What can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that it's, what time is it in England? Okay, well, we finished filming today about 25 minutes ago, so we are shooting the film right now, and I am getting after we open the exhibition tonight, and then as soon as we've opened it, I'm on a plane straight back to London tonight, and I will be back on the set tomorrow in England.
And when does it come out? Is there a release date?
Yep, it's fall next year, fall 2019.
I wanted to come back briefly to the exhibition, and I wanted to know from you, what's the aspect of the exhibition that resonates most for you?
You know, there are so many things. There's some very small individual props that were used in individual episodes that of themselves, you know, are not kind of massive things, but they had quite an intrinsic value within the show. There was a little toy gift that Lady Mary gave to her cousin Matthew long before they were romantically involved, and that's quite poignant. But I think the most, the thing that I find most effective is are those 50 costumes, because what you see in this one large room that all the costumes are displayed in is really the entire narrative of six seasons. You see, you know, everything, well, not, it's not every costume, but the 50 of the most iconic ones. And it reminds you just in one room as you walk through it of many of the great episodes of the, you know, of the show. And beside each costume, there's some narrative that explains exactly what that outfit was used for and what the context was. And it was just for seeing all six seasons revealed in one room that I thought was very effective, because it's not something you'd see if you put the box set in. You'd have to watch 60 hours of drama before you could see all of those costumes.
Yeah. You know, some shows end and people just move on. They forget about it. But this program ended in 2016. Still, though, so much passion for it. Fans still talk about it. Why is that? Why does it still have that? It still resonates.
I think, you know, the characters in particular were so well created by Julian Fellowes. And so well realized by these actors, who most of whom were not particularly well known in the United States when the show first launched, but have become, you know, really remembered for those characters. I think people really they really miss those characters, and I think the movie is long awaited, because people, you know, many people really want to be reunited with these characters, and we've seen them go through so many things in their own lives. So. Yeah, I think it's that's what episodic television does best, is draws, an association with much loved characters, and, you know, no more so than a show like Downton.
Gareth Neame, again, is the executive chairman for Carnival Films, which produced the hit PBS program Downton Abbey. The Downton Abbey exhibition opens in City Place in West Palm Beach with 50 of the original costumes from the show, props, curated museum elements, so much more. You've heard here in this interview. Gareth, I really appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much. We'll have more information on our Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. If you want to check it out, if you're a fan, I'm sure that you will be heading there. Well, that's the program for today, this Thursday, November 8th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend.